So, once again, good evening and welcome to the series on dependent origination. I guess I wanted to start just with a few things. The first thing I wanted to mention is this is where my mind wandered off into my in my sit. Was it for me? It's such a delight to come back here. As Tiska said, I think there's been I've been coming here for a number of years, so I find it so delightful to get to see familiar faces and new faces, and to have the opportunity to sink into your community here. It really is it's a wonderful opportunity for me as well. So I just want to name that. So thank you for inviting me and allowing me to be here. It's a joy, and not only that, to have the opportunity to explore this stuff with you, because I think it's. I find it interesting. We'll see what happens for you. I wonder if we can begin. Actually, what helps me a little bit, and I know it's just a small thing, if we could just go around, I'd love to be able to just hear your name. And if you've already forgotten, which I can do, I'm Brian. Is that everyone? So once again, welcome. So in the past, actually, in some ways, when I say in the past, I want to say in a past life. It feels like this has been so long ago, and it's not a part of my life now that it feels like another life. So we'll say in a past life, I played clarinet in a jazz band. And when I began, one of the things that was foundational, that was really helpful for learning how to play, in particular in a band and learning how to play jazz, was something called, which some of you who are in the kind of musical arts might be familiar with, the 12-bar blues, which is, if you're not familiar with that, it's a structure that you find, and actually once you know the structure, you hear the structure of the 12-bar blues, not only in blues songs, but in some jazz tunes, and it's very common in popular music. And it's a particular chord progression of the one chord, the four chord, and the five chord in any key. And it was very helpful for me to start to hear, to be able to hear this chord progression when I was listening to music, and to get a sense of chord progressions in general. It was foundational. And then what happened from that is that I cultivated this sensitivity to whatever chord progression that was being used in any blues tune or jazz tune that we were playing together in the band, which was essential. It was also essential for learning how to do improvisation, because if I could listen to my band members and get a sense of where we were in the chord progression, then I had a much more a feeling of connection with everyone there. So it was the foundation that allowed this musical art to thrive. And what I want to share with you and propose to you for this residency is that this teaching of dependent origination is also a foundation for the Buddhist teaching that you find, you could say, in early Buddhism. And for that matter, I also want to propose that it's not only a foundation for the teachings, but a way of being, our spiritual life. And that's why I wanted to entitle this, that this is really an art of living. And that if you start to understand this foundation, hopefully in a felt sense, I think you'll get a sense of how helpful it is for this activity of living that we're doing together, for your spiritual practice. And you hear the Buddha also echo what I'm saying. For example, in one of the discourses, he says, "One who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma, or the Dharma. And one who sees the Dharma sees dependent origination." In this context, you could say the Dharma being either the teachings or the way things are. This is foundational. This is essential. And I do find it helpful. I find it helpful in terms of how I'm practicing meditation. Oh, I might be reflecting on some aspect of my life in relationship to the spiritual path. I find it very helpful in terms of ethics, in terms of practicing what are called the Brahma Viharas, cultivating kindness and compassion and appreciative joy and equanimity. and even cultivating community, which I so appreciate of something that happens here in the Sangha. And if you look in what I'm going to call early Buddhism, in these discourses of the Buddha, you'll find dependent origination takes these different forms. For example, you'll see that the classical teaching on the dependent origination are these 12 links of dependent origination, which most people are familiar with. But it's interesting, it doesn't always happen in that form. Sometimes there's 10 links, sometimes there's 11 links, sometimes there's 9 links. And what I would like to really focus on is just a simple phrase that I think captures the essence of dependent origination. And it's not only because I don't like long lists, and it's true, I have a hard time remembering these things. So if there's anything smaller than 8, 4 is great, 3. So you'll hear this is maybe easier to get a sense of. And it's this phrase that's connected with the expression of dependent origination, and I want to share it with you. It goes like this: when this is, that is. From the arising of this comes the arising of that. When this isn't, that isn't. From the cessation of this comes the cessation of that. So again, I just want to repeat that. When this is, that is. From the arising of this comes the arising of that. When this isn't, that isn't. From the cessation of this comes the cessation of that. What is this referring to? It's referring to this basic fabric that we find within our world and in our experience, that of conditionality. When you have one condition, another condition can arise. When you extinguish one condition, the other condition can stop. You know, many examples. I think a perfect example of this is a flower in a garden. There's certain conditions that need to be there. You need soil with certain kinds of nutrients in it. You need the moisture. You need the sunlight. You need the seed. And all of those coming together are the conditions that give rise to the flower. You might take away one of those or two of those conditions, right? There's a ceasing of some conditions, and then the flower will die. It's that simple, that there's conditions that give rise to other conditions. And I think you'll see that there's so much depth just to this simple teaching. And we can see it all over the place. When I was driving out here, I just drove from Arizona today. And I love that drive. And first of all, the first thing that hit me was just appreciation that I get to live in the Southwest with so much space. And to drive through these vast expanses of land, I find incredibly moving. And I think also it touches me in terms of my spiritual practice too, because it's a recognition, which I think is harder to do sometimes for me, at least in the city, is how this activity of living that I'm engaged in is dependently originated. It is dependent upon other conditions. It's dependent upon this earth being at a very particular distance from the sun and from all these different conditions that are here on this earth, down to the very simple thing like bees, of how dependent this living is on pollination. And probably when you start to hear this, something that we're going to get into next week is how already with this teaching of conditionality, we see this impulse towards a kind of ethics. If I start to get this feeling sense of this interdependent quality of my life, what does that mean in terms of how I conduct myself in this world? And this fits in with the Pali word. So dependent origination comes from, it's a translation of these Pali words, paticca samuppada. And I think a helpful translation is paticca, this comes from Joanna Macy, to understand that on account of what? Samuppada. So the last part, the upada, comes from a verb upajati, which means to arise. And then the samu means together. So it's the arising on account of things arising together or arising in close proximity, dependent upon one another, these things arise. Just like I was talking about the flower or this activity of living that we're engaged in, dependently originated with the activity of the earth. And this is the first thing that I want to point out in terms of dependent origination, is just this simple thing that things are interwoven together. Things interdependently arise, just in the examples that I gave. John Muir put it so well when he was exploring the Sierra Nevada in California. And I love this because I love the image that it evokes as well. He says, when we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. Isn't that true? Right. You pick out anything, you pick out anything. And you try to pick it out by itself, but rather you find it hitched to everything else in the universe. Or even more striking, this passage from a short story by Alison Luderman. Someone who is picking strawberries, this woman, in the short story. She says, strawberries were too delicate to be picked by machine. The perfectly ripe ones bruised at even too heavy a human touch. It hit her that every strawberry she had ever eaten, every piece of fruit, had been picked by calloused human hands. Every piece of toast with jelly represented someone's knees, someone's aching back and hips, someone with a bandana on her wrist to wipe away the sweat. Why had no one told her about this before? Just in a strawberry or a toast with jelly on it. I find this such a moving example. Someone's aching back, their knees, the calloused hands. And again, I think you can start to hear the reverberation of this, the implications of touching our experience or touching the world in this sense of really getting a feeling sense of dependent origination. So that's the first thing that I'm sure we'll come back to again and again. One of the things that's interesting about early Buddhism, though, is that this teaching of dependent origination is used in a very, very specific context. Kind of this interdependent quality and the ethical implications really flowers much later on in Buddhism. And what you find in early Buddhism is there's this specific arena of getting clear about this activity of conditionality in terms of your freedom and our freedom collectively, and your suffering, your dukkha, your dis-ease, that not quite rightness in your life. What are the conditions that give rise to your suffering or your difficulty? What are the conditions there? What are the conditions there that lead to your freedom? And in a very particular way, seeing dependent origination in a very refined way, because it's about particular conditions. And I want to give another example of dependent origination so we get a sense of this. And the other example I want to give you actually comes from another teacher, Lee Brazington, and I appreciate it because it will pop out some of these important aspects of dependent origination. So the example is this light right here. It's dependently originated. There is light that's happening right now because of a number of conditions. You have the light bulb, you have the filaments in the light bulb. You have the wires, you have the light switch in a particular position. You have the breaker box outside. You have all those wires probably around Albuquerque. And then you have, where's your power? What power plant does your power plant come from? Or actually, in Flagstaff, our power mostly comes from New Mexico, the Four Corners power plant. Does anybody know what the, does it come for Four Corners? There's probably a number of them. Great. Palo Verde? Oh, the nuclear? Oh, really? Oh, interesting. Oh, so very similar to us. So, and then we have the power plant, like the Four Corners power plant that's burning coal, or the Palo Verde power plant that's running on nuclear power. And what the Buddha was curious about is basically, it is what would be the best way to make that light bulb go off? And there'd be many ways. We could have some kind of social action or vandalism, go up to Four Corners, stop all the coal. That would be one way. But it would take a lot of work to make that light bulb go off to do it that way. We could turn off the breaker box. We could get a ladder, maybe with a glove because it might be warm, unscrew the light bulb. Or we can find the light switch. The light switch is the is an important condition because it's the one that we can most easily influence. And this is really the Buddha's discovery, is he found the light switch. He was curious about, where's the light switch for your discontent, for your suffering, for your dis-ease? Because if you can find the light switch, things get a lot easier. Or the light switch for your freedom. And I find this actually a really rich question to keep alive. Because you're going to notice that often what I notice about my mind is I miss the light switch. You ever notice this? You have some kind of conflict with somebody. They write you that email or that text. Your boss or your coworker or your partner. And I notice my mind is driving way out to the Four Corners power plants. I love them. I love her. But if only they had just a slightly different personality. And if I could control that, it would be great. Do you find your mind driving out there the way my mind does? Oh, there might be a light switch. Where's the light switch with that? Right? It might be, we can do this around emotions too. Sometimes there's a sense of going out to Four Corners. How can I control my emotions? How can I feel less of this emotion and more of this emotion? How can I control my internal environment? Have you noticed this? And you might notice it around particular emotions. Where's the light switch? You know, with emotions, finding the light switch of this skill of actually being with what's arising, simply noticing it, having this friendly, aware quality to it. So we can allow that flow of emotion to happen with being aware of it without being hooked by it. Maybe it's skillful communication with others. And really what I want to be sharing with you over these weeks is in many ways just finding the skillful light switches. And in light of that, I actually want to do just a little experiment. What I invite you to do is just to take some time to go inward now. If we could just maybe close your eyes or look down at the ground. Maybe feeling your body sitting there. And as you sense inside, I invite you to bring to mind some difficulty in your life. And if it's not a difficulty, maybe some challenge or where the edge is for you. And can you get a sense of, with that difficulty, where's the light switch that can start to at least dim the entanglement with that? There might be a few light switches. And similarly, you might want to reflect on, where is the light switch that leads to freedom, that makes this challenge a gateway to your freedom? Taking time to reflect. And then also taking some time to reflect on, where's the Four Corners power plant? Where is it in terms of that place that isn't the condition that's most influenced, that you get hooked by? And then opening your eyes, coming back into the room. So it might be an interesting way to reflect on some of the things in your life, of asking where the light switches are and where the distant things are that we're taking for the light switch that we have very little influence on. And I just want to point out, this is something that can be in our lives, but it can also be in our meditation. Like the other day, here I am, I'm sitting down, I'm feeling the breathing, and then my mind gets lost. It gets lost in the to-do list, in the planning. And where's the light switch around that? Because it can be so compelling, wanting to be the person that gets everything done on the to-do list, or figuring that out, or feeling like I have control of my day. And there, the light switch is so immediate. It's right there. It's right about being mindful that that's what's happening. And disengaging from that. And I just want to say one thing about the disengagement, that in mindfulness, it's not just being mindful of what's going on. It's being aware of really some of the other aspects of it. It was important for me to see that in that moment, my contentment does not lie in planning. I need to reflect on that. And sometimes I do reflect on that, because there can be a sense of just noting that planning is happening in my mind. But I still, the mind still wants to go there. Oh, interesting. This is not connected. This is not the light switch to my contentment in this moment. And then I might feel it in my body. And then there's this different relationship to the planning. There's the gateway to my freedom and letting go, beginning to allow the conditions to be there for the letting go. And in this analogy, just the example I gave, I want to also point out where this analogy of the light switch breaks down, because this is very important. When you think about a light switch, I feel like I have quite a bit of control over that. And it's so immediate. And those are the two things I want to talk about, how it doesn't work that way. Because I think one of the hooks around this is this sense of our experience, or even sometimes the environment, of I should be in control or I am in control. You ever notice this kind of thought process? I should be in control of what I'm feeling. I should be in control of this situation. And then we can bring this to our meditation practice. You know, you sit down and you meditate. Maybe you've meditated for a few months, a few years, even a few decades. And then there's that day where your mind is just lost in thought, or you're agitated. And then there can be this kind of feeling of, what am I doing wrong? Or there must be something wrong with me that I can't do this. And do you hear within that, that is in the frame that I am in control. That is not an understanding of conditionality. Because conditionality is more these influences on the moment. It's not these direct linear correlations. It's not like the light switch in that way. These are just mere these mere conditions that I can influence, that can change things, change the direction. Just like with the planning mind, I can become mindful of it, I can disengage, but of course it's still going to arise. But I'm putting forth the conditions to allow the mind to trend in a different direction. But I can't make it go there in this direct linear way. Is this making sense? So in some ways, and actually we'll talk about this in the study group, this is different than kind of a basic a causality relationship. Conditions are different in this sense. And it's more, a more fluid understanding. And can you notice when your mind gets hooked by when you put yourself in the position of thinking that you are in control? I find this so relieving, and again, we'll get into this next week, especially when dealing with difficult situations. What can I influence here? And there's a place to influence the situation, and when it goes south, or it goes in a way that I don't want it to, that's just the way it is, because I'm not in complete control. That's the deep understanding of dependent origination. And can you hear on that level how freeing that is? How we can have a different relationship to experience when we really get this? So this is a shaping model rather than a model of control. A quote from the Buddha from the Dhammapada, which is a collection of the Buddha sayings. again, these images that I think express this. He says, irrigators guide the water, fletchers shape the arrow shaft, carpenters shape the wood, the wise fashion themselves. Irrigators guide the wood, guide the water, fletchers shape the arrow shaft, carpenters shape the wood, the wise fashion themselves. Again, do you hear the sense of shaping, of influencing rather than controlling? And I think this is how this is an art. Many of you that are involved in some kind of artistic endeavor know the feeling of not being in complete control. And that's the sense of sometimes of an artistic endeavor, is it's much more subtle than that. And again, it's coming back to this practice. I have the intention to cultivate mindfulness. I have the intention to cultivate kindness, mindfulness, compassion. But it doesn't mean that it's always going to be there or it's going to be this immediate link. I plant the seed for the flower. I water it, but I'm not in control of when it's going to arise. And yet we can get involved in the sense of kind of digging up the seed to see if it sprouted. It just doesn't work that way. And when I get this, I feel like I can surrender more deeply to this path in cultivating conditions and realizing I'm not in control. Again, another example of this. This is a poem from Mary Oliver, the poem The Uses of Sorrow. It's interesting. Her description of this poem is, she said that in her sleep she dreamed this poem. It's very simple. She said, someone I loved once gave me a box full of darkness. It took me years to understand that this too was a gift. Again, someone I loved once gave me a box full of darkness. It took me years to understand that this too was a gift. First of all, I appreciate her description of sometimes the experience that you have with others. Have you ever had that experience? Someone that you once loved. And what did they give you? This feeling of a box full of darkness. Have you ever had such a human experience and the pain of that and how difficult it is to navigate that? And then the turn that she invites us towards, to understanding that this too was a gift. And that's the true light switch. This is the light switch that is in the essence, especially in our meditation. And what is it? It's the change in relationship to my experience. How am I relating to this experience? That's the huge shift. That's where I have the most influence. Another example of this. A few weeks ago, I had a bike crash. It was on this bike I got mountain biking. And it was a bad crash, and I was in a lot of pain. And I just want to say, it's a miracle I didn't break a bone. I still can't figure that out. Like, what's up with that? And it was interesting to see where my mind wanted to go and the places where I could see where the light switch was around that. So when I got home, there was a couple of light switches. There was pain, but it wasn't overwhelming pain. So it was this recognition, oh, I just need to hang out and be with this pain. And to notice also the mind wanting to go to, oh, this shouldn't have happened. Or this was the worst day for this to happen. And of course that arose. And it was just important to see that. To see that that's where the mind wanted to go. So I couldn't completely control that. But to be mindful of that. And to notice that that wasn't a direction that I was interested in going in. Which is really, what am I explaining there? It's just the simple practice of mindfulness. Of being aware. Of from the very rudimentary aspect of our experience of sensation, that it's unpleasant, the reactivity around that, and simply being with that, being aware of that, how it came and go, how it ebbed and flowed. And there were other aspects that also I was putting into it. I was super grateful. One, I still, like, when I think about this, I can't believe how grateful I am. I am so grateful for bicycle helmets. Like, I would not be here right now probably being able to talk to you if there wasn't a thing as bicycle helmets. It was, I think, one of the first things I hit, and it felt so squishy and soft, the bicycle helmet. They're wonderful inventions. And I used to always put on my bicycle helmet, but now there's something in me that gets so joyful about the idea of a bicycle helmet. And then the other thing, which was that I didn't break a bone. So the first thing I did is I actually called my mother. And I said, thank you so much for the jeans you gave me. I feel so lucky. So there was also a cultivation of a certain state of mind that I was bringing to that as well. I had options of many different light switches. So this was turning on the light switch of gratitude, which actually was very helpful also in the coming days. That when I felt the pain, I could also recognize how lucky I was. You know, and there could be other light switches. It could be, you know, maybe reflecting on being, you know, recognizing my age and being a little bit more, I wasn't being very careful to tell you the truth when I was writing, and being a little bit more cautious when I'm writing. That's a light switch that I feel like still is coming that I need to work on, so we'll see how that one goes. And you'll notice that some light switches are a little bit easier to turn on and off than others. I like to think of myself as really young and fit, which there's a word for that. Delusion. You know that. And then a last quality, again, that we'll probably come back to is if we're living in a world of just conditions arising and passing away, and it's conditions that are coming together that form my discontent and my suffering and my disease and the conditions that arise that allow the mind to move towards awakening and freedom, then there's no reason to take it personally. And again, I found that this has been such a big realization in my own practice, and I want to tie it also to the First Noble Truth. Remember, the First Noble Truth that the Buddha gave us was the simple fact that there's suffering, which I'm always struck by, because he didn't start the spiritual path with some kind of belief system or some kind of philosophy or cosmology about how the world began. It was something that all of us here in the room can probably relate to, right? Is there anyone in this room that has never experienced difficulty or suffering or dukkha or disease? It's something immediate. And I think there's something brilliant about that. But it's not only that. The statement that there is suffering, so what's not there? I am suffering. It's such a turn when I can notice when there is dukkha in my life that there are certain causes, there are certain conditions that are arising that give rise to this. Oh, interesting. There's this unpleasant sensation. There's the unpleasant sound of my neighbor's dog barking. Interesting. Oh, and then there's some reactivity to it, like really not liking it, really wanting to get on the phone and calling them right now at 3:00 in the morning. Oh, there's the reactivity. Oh, and that combination of an unpleasant sound and an entanglement with that sound, and then the whole storyline gives rise. Those are the conditions that give rise to discontent. Interesting. It doesn't mean I'm a bad person for having these thoughts about my neighbor. It's just the conditions that are unfolding. I find it so helpful. And it doesn't mean that I now become a victim or I don't take responsibility, for example, for my actions. It just allows for a certain kind of freedom around all this. It's actually not about me. It's about conditions. Have you noticed the hook that comes when we get entangled when it's all about me? Great cartoon. I don't know if you're going to be able to see it, so I'll describe it. But it's the caption says local showers, and there's this fellow that's running with some holding these newspapers, it looks like, trying to shield themselves from the rain, with this it looks like these rain showers only hitting them. In the caption, the person saying, "Why me?" It feels like that, though, doesn't it? So often, why me? This is all about me. Oh no, these are just the conditions that the causes and conditions that arise. And just one story about this. I think getting conditionality can be so profound. There's a man I was working with a few years ago, and he living in Los Angeles, and he was he had a few children, a son and a daughter, and the daughter, unfortunately, when I think she was 17 or 18, had gotten severely assaulted. I'll just say that. I mean, it was really horrendous by a number of men, held at knife point, and really severely assaulted. And so it was not only a huge ordeal for his daughter, but for the whole family. And years of trying to navigate this. I mean, it's really interesting. His daughter, I think, moved through it more quickly than he did, which makes sense. I think being a parent, there can be so much that comes around that. And the breakthrough after many years of working through it in many different ways, so I don't want to disregard that, was the moment of really, I think, of healing, of it all coming together, is actually coming into a different physiological state and finally realizing these were just the conditions that came together. And I think he said it was so interesting because one of the things that I think he was embarrassed to say, I mean, this wasn't a practitioner, but it was naturally arising, is he said, you know, I hate to say it, but it's such a strong feeling. I have so much compassion for the perpetrators now, too. And it wasn't like he was condoning that kind of behavior, but it was a complete recognition that there's all these conditions in their life, all these conditions in her life, in society, that brought these together for this very tragic thing to happen. And I think it was from there that he had a sense of being able to engage in life in a very skillful way. So it wasn't like getting to a place of passivity, but a place of being able to be responsive rather than reactive. And really, it's such a moving thing to see. And it was based on seeing conditions, these conditions bumping into each other. So next week, what we'll be exploring is really this realm of action, karma, and how to bring this into how do we act in the world. Because again, I think it can form how we do act in the world. And to point out that this practice is not only about what we're doing on the cushion, it's about how we engage with the world. And how does your spiritual practice inform that? And then also next week there'll be a study group where we can go a little bit more in depth with some of these points that I made and to have a chance to explore them and discuss them. Yeah, and then again, I just want to emphasize, I leave you with this question of where's the light switch, and to come back to that. I think it can be fruitful in some way. So, may our understanding of dependent origination lead to our own liberation as well as the liberation of all beings. Thank you.